Well, good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station, the one, 95.1 FM, and of course for over 50 years, KYMN AM 1080 on your AM dial. Okay, it feels like Monday, I know, because it is Tuesday, and yesterday I was surprised as I got up to come to work and I saw my wife. And I'm going, wait a minute, hey, you, wake up, you're going to be late. And, oh, no, I got the day off. I thought, oh, I didn't know that. So she enjoyed a day off, and I got to spend the day with my wife. That's pretty nice on a Monday. But this is Tuesday for those of you that are listening some years in the future. Today is January 22nd, and the year is 2019, and the weather situation right around 20 degrees, and it is overcast here in Northfield, Minnesota, as we broadcast live from our booth. Here on Division Street, downtown Northfield, historical downtown Northfield. And I got a little bit nervous. I was going to get historical because my guest wasn't here a few minutes ago. And at exactly 9 o'clock, just when the Wayne Eddy Affair theme song, Rebel Rouser, came on, my gentleman friend sat down in the chair, put on his earphones, and thank you for making me a little bit nervous. You must have been busy this morning, huh?
Well, after you throw me all those hard questions last week, I feel like I had to make you a little nervous, too.
Oh, no, no, no. We are, of course, talking to a gentleman by the name of Charlie Cogan, part two, and it looks like you were at school today, huh, Charlie?
Right, for Breakfast Buddies. It's a reading program for kids.
Oh, well, tell us about it.
You know, it's done by the school district, and I think it's Scott Richardson is the president of the Rotary Club, and I think it's his daughter.
Oh.
Who is running this program, and it's designed to bring adults into the breakfast when the kids are having their quick breakfast before they start school and read books. And so there are a ton of books.
And what grades?
These are kids probably from about first to fifth.
First to fifth.
Right. The kindergartners, I think, are too energetic, so they've got their own kind of thing going on.
Yeah. You know, how many times have you and I and everybody else have seen various Minnesota Vikings or politicians of sorts reading to kids? And I'm always thinking when I watch a video of that, some of the kids are squirming, and some of the kids ask some very cute questions. What is it like as an adult to, you got to be past 40 by now.
Oh, yeah.
And you to sit down.
Almost another 50% past that.
Okay, 60.
Yeah.
And do you sit on a little chair? Do you gather them on the floor and read to them? And what books do you choose? And what do you do if they aren't paying attention?
Well, they're boxes full of books. And so they're in these plastic containers, and you can come and pick any one you want to. And I'd been getting the top one for probably 2 or 3 months, and it's usually the same box. So I went down to the bottom and pulled one out, and it was nice. And then you have to sit down at the lunch tables where the kids are sitting, and,
okay.
And I'm not as limber as I used to be, so sometimes it takes a little work to get shoehorned in there. But yeah. I think the kids are sitting there. Usually today there were no other readers. Sometimes there are two other readers, depending on the day. And usually I can't go today, but I could today. So there were no other readers, and so a lot of maybe 15, 16 kids were at the table I sat down at. A couple of kids at the other table were all by themselves, and so they just came over and joined us. And I read one about a polar bear who gets whose iceberg breaks off, and then he ends up in probably Latin America somewhere with a hippopotamus, and then he finds his way home. And then the next book was a really kind of a neat book about this little boy who wakes up and it's snowing outside. And it was nice, but what really struck me is that I finished the book, and the bell rang, so the kids had to go off. And one of the girls actually said, you know, this reminds me of a poem by Shel Silverstein. And
wow.
It's a poem I didn't know, and it's a beautiful poem. She actually knew it by heart. So I'm thinking, here I think I'm bringing literacy to the kids, but these kids are as literate as I am. It's just a fun activity.
They do pay attention, then?
Oh, I think usually. I mean, it's not supposed to be homework. So if a couple of kids are talking on the side, they should talk.
I mean, okay.
But the ones who are sitting nearby will often interact.
And do you have a teacher that's available to, straighten out any kids that aren't paying attention and interrupting?
I used to be a teacher myself, so I think the kids don't really. They're pretty good kids. I mean, this is a town that values reading and things like that. So I would say in general, some of the kids might be riled up because of something, and then they might go off and talk about something else. But the ones who are sitting with you tend to be pretty attentive and ask good questions and choose the book they'd rather read than the one you're reading and things like that. But that's nice.
Aren't they picture books?
Yeah, some of them are picture books. There's one called The Secret Garden that I really found pretty touching about a. Well, I mean, I don't want to tell the whole story, but it's a pretty touching book.
Why can't you tell the whole story?
It's a little girl who is living in India during the colonial days in Britain, and she's pretty spoiled. She has servants, and her parents are colonial administrators, and so she has the good life, but she's got kind of a sour expression on her face. And then her parents and her servants and everyone else die of a disease. There's an outbreak of something. This is 19th century, so she ends up at her uncle's place, and the uncle's place looks a little bit like Wuthering Heights, sort of a forbidding-looking big mansion. And on the way to the house, she's talking with the maid. And the maid is talking about the old man who is all bent down and his son died 10 years ago and things like that. And she sort of says, why do I care about this? You know, why are you wasting my time? And the maid says, wow, you're just like your uncle. And so it starts out with them the uncle's away traveling. And so she little by little finds out that there was a secret garden that the uncle's wife used to tend. And the garden is locked up and there's no key. So she decides she wants to find the key, and she finds a little boy who helps her find the key. And then they get in, they start fixing up the garden. And then it turns out that they discover that the uncle's son has been in a wheelchair since he was little, because when he was born, the mother died. And so the father was convinced that the son was going to be sick too. And so it's kind of one of these little stories, you know, and it ends up with, I think this must be the kids' version because I bet it's a longer story. But it ends up with the father coming back and surprising them in the garden, and then being amazed that his son is walking around and helping tend the garden. And so it's a happy ending, which I think is good for kids' books.
Yeah, it was getting a little dreary there, people dying all the time.
No. So it's
what happened to the old bent over man?
He became a little bit, you know, sort of like Scrooge on the third ghost. He starts to kind of wake up a little bit and realize that maybe he should be a different person than he is. He stands up a little straighter and is excited to see his son not in the wheelchair, and so.
I can see where that would hold their attention.
Oh, my gosh, it does. And it doesn't have any pictures. It had a few. But it was a lot of text. And when I opened it up, I thought, wow, this could be tough because I'm going to try to keep these kids. But they actually had read it before, I think,
okay.
In school. And so a lot of them knew the story, and they would tune in and tell the other kids what was coming and stuff like that. So
now, do you use an inflection and pauses and all of that?
To the extent that I can. I mean, I've been reading to my kids for years. And when I was little, my parents are both teachers. So my mother used to read to us before bed, and she did a good job. I mean, I think she's the one who got all of us reading because it sounded like so much fun. And I'm not sure I'm as talented as she is, but I try.
Okay. You know, I was just thinking as you were talking about that, I don't remember a whole lot of anybody reading to me at all, but I came across an old book, and it was a brown cover with a squirrel on it, and the binding was kind of ripped.
Right.
And I don't know where it is right now, but I ran across it in my adult life, and I opened it up, and I looked at it, and it was about storing nuts. And I don't recall that book, but I think I put my name in it when I learned how to write, and it's little kids writing, you know.
Right.
And I thought, oh, I should just keep this. Who knows? So, well, thank you for sharing that. What school were you at this morning?
It was at Sibley School.
Sibley, okay. Yeah. And, of course, the bell rang, and the kids had to go to class, and you had to come to KYMN Radio.
Right.
And I called you because I was getting a little nervous. And
I was parking right by that beautiful Carnegie Library over there. So.
Well, why couldn't you park right in front here?
I wasn't that adventurous. Sometimes I get over here and there isn't a parking spot. So I thought if I parked over there, I knew I had a...
On Third Street, then?
A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, right?
Hey, okay. I've heard that one before, yes. Yeah. Speaking about worth, there's a place in Northfield called the Quarterback Club in Northfield. And, boy, do you get your money's worth when you go in there and have a breakfast. They have anything from coffee and donuts, and then they go from there to scrambled eggs, poached eggs, soft-boiled eggs, hard-boiled eggs, scrambled eggs, over-easy eggs, sunny-side-up, name it, they do it. And, of course, they have pancakes, they have waffles, they have Malt-A-Meal. They've got it all at the QB, the Quarterback Club, locally owned, locally managed by Dale Finger and the entire crew, a couple, has been there for over 40 years doing breakfast, Steve and Lori Eastrom. And every morning at 11 o'clock, if you want to know who they are, they sit in the same booth every morning at 11 o'clock and have their breakfast right there at the Quarterback Club. Then they get back to work for the rush hour of noon. And don't forget their baby back barbecued ribs with mountains of oozeness just flowing across those ribs with that special sauce. Boy.
Now I'm getting hungry.
Yeah, they are good. I have to ask you something. And does the name Crimson Education mean anything to you?
Sure, sure. That's the company that I've been working for off and on for a year, but consistently for about 4 months.
Okay, and the reason I ask that is I have a few notes from the last time you were here, and we talked about Long Island. We talked about Jersey City. We talked about Bayonne. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay, and we talked about Castle, Vermont.
Castleton,
Vermont, and we talked about Kirksville, Missouri.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, you are married. Are you married to Deidre? Is that your daughter?
No, Deidre is my sister.
Your sister.
That's a beautiful Irish name. There's an old Deirdre. Irish thing yeah. called Deirdre of the Sorrows.
When Deirdre's eyes are
right.
smiling.
Right.
And then is it true that you have a brother named Alan or a sister?
It goes Charlie, Deirdre,
Alan,
Aylin,
Dana,
Tasha,
Caitlin.
And Caitlin. Right.
Got it.
A whole mess.
Are your siblings.
Those are all siblings.
Okay, so we didn't get to, I looked at my book and I think 1978.
I think we got to about junior high school.
Yeah, okay. So, and that would be in Kirksville?
Kirksville, birthplace of osteopathic medicine.
Okay. You know, oh, by the way, you know what I just learned this weekend? Who the heck was that I was talking to? And he said he worked at Sheldahl.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yeah, used to be Sheldahl. He said, no, it's Sheldahl. I said, no, it's that other place that bought them out. No, it's Sheldahl. I said, really? And I said, when did that happen? He said, about a month ago. I didn't know that. So I feel comfortable now. Sheldahl, I mean, that's a name in Northfield that
right.
everybody knows. So hooray for Sheldahl. I don't know the total situation there at all, so I can't say who bought it or what the deal is, but I do remember him saying, yep, there's a Sheldahl, so I had to get that off my chest. So we're in junior high school in Kirksville, and I can't recall, was it 6, 7, and 8, 7, 8, and 9?
It was 7, 8, 9.
7, 8, 9. And in middle school, that's when the testosterone and all the other stuff starts going. And you used to be a teacher, and I don't know if you taught those junior high kids, but, boy, that's a job that you have to respect and appreciate teachers because that's a crazy time in a growing area.
You feel a little bit more like a referee.
Did you teach junior high kids?
I never did.
Oh, okay.
I used to substitute teach.
Okay.
And I think when I got the junior high classes, I just crossed myself before I went in and did the best I could.
Was the building independent of the high school?
The junior high in Kirksville, Missouri was right on the campus of the university because the university used to be a teacher's college. I guess it is still a teacher's college. It was a normal school. And it was called Kirksville State Teachers College. So the junior high was right there so that it was sort of the laboratory where the student teachers could come over and teach us. So we got to be guinea pigs quite a bit.
Well, what is that called when, like, the University of Minnesota gets support, of course, from the state and
right.
federal on grants, et cetera? And there's a name for that that they were installed, a century ago or more.
Sure.
So if you have that school on campus, and it's Kirksville, Missouri, was it a private school?
No, it belonged to the city of Kirksville, but it was based right on the campus because historically you need teachers. And so since there was a teacher's college in town, they just built it. I think the university gave the city the building on the condition that they would put the junior high school there.
Okay.
When I was in junior high school, that's where the junior high was. A few years later, they built a beautiful, a little bit like Northfield, where you built a beautiful new middle school.
Mm-hmm.
Kirksville built a beautiful new middle school that was sort of out a little bit further away from the university. But when I was there, it was the olden days, and so we were taught right on the campus.
The olden days.
Right, the olden days. It was called Ophelia Parish Junior High School.
Well, like when I go to a class reunion high school, I remember we all say, hey, let's go over to how did that go? Anyhow, we always...
The White Center? Or?
No, this is back in St. Paul. But anyhow, I know what it was. We would refer to the present school as the new school.
Right.
And the new school is over 50 years old. I mean, it's just that's the way you do it. You know,
right.
Hey, have you been to the new high school?
Well, it's new for you.
Yeah. So anyhow, I was just wondering how they taxed in regards to the fact that this teacher's school dedicated a building that they own. I would imagine they must have had to lease it or something.
You know, they probably did. They probably leased it to the city at a very good price so that they could have the benefit of having all of these students to practice on within walking distance.
Well, that
the University of Chicago has a school like that called the Lab School.
Okay.
That's right next to the campus. And so that way the students don't have to get in a car and drive across. Because I think when that arrangement started, students didn't have their own cars. And then by the 50s, you know, teenagers had their own cars. And so they could drive, you know, 2 or 3 miles away to teach. But back, you know, in the olden days, it was nice to have that high school or the junior high right there on campus.
And so the high school was how far from your home?
By the time I got there, we were in the new high school. So the new high school was out where, you know, sort of, I would say, on the edge of town, so that you could have football fields and track and fields and tennis courts and all the kinds of good things that you want to have. So it was on the edge of the town, and from the high school on out, just was moving out towards the farms.
Did you ever notice how churches build way outside of the community, and years later, the community builds past them?
Right.
You know, there's several. Faribault's a great example with their Catholic church.
Divine Mercy.
Yeah. I mean, it's way out there now.
Right.
But it will eventually be, you know, built up, I'm sure, with neighborhoods, et cetera.
There's one like that on Cedar Avenue where I think the church sold some land to a shopping mall so that they could get started up. It's right on Cedar Avenue and Dodd Road.
Oh, okay.
And then what happened is the shopping mall grew. The church is there so that they were able to take that money and build a retirement home right next to the church. And so now everybody has the retirement home where they can walk over to the mall and get their food. I think there's a couple of foods there. So that when I first moved here, and I'm not a real veteran, but I think 18 years ago when I first moved here, that didn't exist. None of it existed. And then every year you'd see something new popping up, and now it's actually pretty.
Well, imagine how I feel watching it grow. You know, the old Piper Inn pizza place was way out in the country.
Right.
And, you know, that was a stop on the way to a Viking game or on the way back, I should say. And now, I mean, they got a perfect spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. They used to have an old Piper Inn here in Northfield, believe it or not, on in the Riverside Mall.
Okay.
You know, where Mr. Movies used to be.
Right, of course.
All that started off as the old Piper Inn.
When I was a student here, there was a bar restaurant called Marty's.
Yeah, that was in the same location.
We talked about disco music, and I was thinking that when Marty's existed, he used to play disco music, and so we'd all get our gold chains and our shirts buttoned down about halfway to our chest. And
I used to frequent that place frequently, and I even have a big frying pan when he went out of business. I bought one of those big metal frying pans that you grease up and.
He was my basketball coach's son, so we sometimes would get a little treat. We'd get to go over there and have a nice dinner.
He was your...
Jack Thernblad was my basketball coach.
Oh, okay. So you went to Carleton.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking about him the other day. What a guy. Great guy.
Oh, and I think Carleton came back from behind to upset St. John's on Saturday. And I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, because absolutely.
St. John's had a great team, yeah. but I think Carleton just stuck in there and hung in there until they got a chance, and then they overcame just the last 15 seconds.
Did you get a book, Jack Turnblad's
book? I have a copy, but I don't think I was good enough to make it into the book, but I liked it because Jack was in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember having him on the air, and I jokingly said, well, if I ever want one of your books, should I just stop over and meet you at your garage?
Yeah.
You know, because self-published books or whatever, sometimes you have a few left over.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, my guest this morning on the Wayne Eddy Affair is Charlie Cogan, part two. And Charlie, I don't know whether we should leap to high school, or did you have a really fun middle school experience, junior high, 7, 8, 9?
I would say I have a few memories from junior high. One is that the town that I was in was in northeast Missouri. It's a wonderful town, but not all of the students were equally motivated, so there were some 7th graders when I first came into 7th grade who really should have been 9th graders, but they weren't very motivated, but they couldn't drop out until they turned 16, and they were awfully tough. So I remember one time the teacher got called off to the office, and the 7th graders who were 2 or 3 years older than us rounded up a bunch of us kids and shook us down for our lunch money. and they threatened us with destruction if we ever told the teacher, and I thought that was an interesting... That was an interesting abuse of power, but I remember a couple of years later, we'd all grown, and we weren't afraid of those guys anymore. But, you know, when you're in that 7th grade period, a lot of kids haven't had that growth spurt, and so 2 years makes a huge difference. Those kids looked like giants when we were in 7th grade.
No, do I picture, should I picture them as individuals that might have appeared in the movie that Burt Reynolds was in? Remember Deliverance?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, you could. They actually, some of them turned out to be very nice people. I run into them when I go back to my hometown, and they've mellowed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, they were in school. They didn't really want to be in school, and so we were going to pay for it. And
okay.
It was one of those learning experiences, and I think.
So what was it like being a freshman? I guess you'd go in as a sophomore at, was it called Kirksville High?
Kirksville Senior High. It was nice because in 9th grade you didn't play on the high school teams, which meant that you weren't very last. You were actually, as a 9th grader, sort of getting ready for high school. And so we actually had 9th grade teams that were fun. We did a good job. I thought the school taught us well.
What was the nickname?
The Tigers.
The Tigers. Yeah. All right. So now you enter high school, and you obviously were involved in athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived in town.
Mm-hmm.
And your folks were teachers.
Right.
And so now you're going to, did they teach in your high school?
My mother taught Head Start,
okay.
which is a program for young kids who are getting ready to go to school. And my father was a professor at the local university.
What did he profess?
He professed sports psychology and sociology of sports. He was an old jock, and so he managed to get a doctorate in sports.
Doctorate?
In sports, yeah. And so
wow.
It was sports. His department was physical education. But he was a pretty interesting guy. You know, I think we talked last time about the fact that he was a Korean War veteran, and he had been involved in the recreation program at a prisoner of war camp, and he saw the transformative effects of a good recreation program. So when he got back to the United States, he had a passion for it, and so he really loved teaching sports, coaching sports. And
is he still with us?
He's not. He passed away in 1988, so I think that's been 31 years, right?
Yeah. It's a long time,
but a good person.
Yeah, obviously you loved your dad.
Yeah,
and since your mom was with Head Start and he was at the college, obviously you didn't have the problem of kids teasing you because you got good grades because mommy or daddy helped you out. So that's cool. So now you're in the 9th grade and you look up to the seniors and you're athletically inclined, and you probably know more about sports than anybody because your dad professed that probably
right.
at home too. So did you go out for, well, I would assume the basketball team?
Well, basketball and football in 9th grade, but then moved out of that and then cross country for a little while. By looking at me, you might not guess that, but
no, I was going to say football would have been your forte.
Yeah, it would have been. I loved football, but I think we had a coach who thought he was Bear Bryant. He actually chewed tobacco and spit it on the ground in front of us and yelled at us a lot. And in 9th grade, I enjoyed it. But we would run practice plays where we'd score beautiful touchdowns on passing. And he didn't run a single passing play the entire season. you know, I mean, this is a while ago, but it kind of killed the fun. So, I think I have friends who kept on for all 4 years, but I was a wide receiver and I felt like I was doing nothing but in inconsequential blocks out in the distance somewhere.
But that must have helped in your cross country effort, huh?
Yeah. You get a lot of exercise running off to find somebody to block out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
9:26 on 1080 KYMN Radio. We'll take our first break here on Kim, and we'll come back and continue our conversation, part two, with a fellow by the name of Charlie Chuck Charles Cogan.
You thought you could make a midnight run to the store for a loaf of bread. What you got was a minor fender bender instead. I'm State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell in Northfield, and I know that accidents can happen anytime. That's why we give you 24-hour good neighbor service, so night or day, help is just a phone call away. For your insurance and financial needs, phone me, State Farm Agent Mark Quinnell, at 645-4545.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is.
There's a guy that was a good football player, Mark Quinnell. He played for the Raiders and for the Oldies. I think he was a halfback. You ever hear the expression single wing?
Single wing formation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me the lineup in the background on that. Where do people line up? Now, the tailback would have been like the quarterback.
Okay.
Right?
I think, you know, you're right, but we should get one of the football coaches in here. I'm sure they would be able to diagram it for us.
Yeah, well, I had the St. Olaf football on about nine times.
Yeah.
But I just thought maybe if you played that single wing.
We didn't do anything fun, except in practice. In games, we just ran 44 up the middle.
Okay, so now.
And if that didn't work, we ran 43 up the middle.
Okay, now you're not a really. Okay, if you're not real tall, I mean,
About 5'11".
Yeah, so you liked basketball.
Yeah.
So were you a forward then?
No, I was a shooting guard or a point guard.
Okay, and who was your center? I mean, do you remember your tall
at
center?
At Carleton?
We're still in high school.
In high school, we had a guy named Jeff Darr, who was about 6'4", and gawky, and then there was another kid named Darryl O'Haver, who was a farm kid and could bench press a truck. And was a decent basketball player. So we had pretty strong but not overly tall players in the middle. But they held their own well because they were so doggone strong.
How far did you go in high school?
We would drive. We played Hannibal. We would go down to Columbia, Missouri. We'd get over to Trenton and Chillicothe and Marshall. We'd occasionally get off to Kansas City.
Wow, that's a lot.
So we covered a lot, but gas was cheap back then, right?
I guess it was, yes.
Yeah.
What about the status of the team? Did they ever get into conference play? Playoffs, etc.
You know, we did pretty well. The year after I graduated, the team actually went to the state tournament, and there was one guy who had played guard behind me, and he was about 5'6". The next year, he was about 6'2", he turned out to be quite a good player. And they ended up going to the state tournament. I think they got to about the quarterfinals. And then lost, but they were good. We were one of the better teams in our conference, but not the best. And we probably were missing a part or two. We did have some good players though.
Did the coach chew tobacco?
No, the basketball coaches were a little easier to get along with. And I the coach who chewed tobacco was not a bad person. He was also our PE teacher, but he was just a little rough around the edges, and he had a pretty limited vision of what he wanted us to do, which is to not do anything that was very exciting. So, but, you know, they won some games in football, and some of my good friends played on those teams, and they, as they got into high school, they did actually get a little bit more adventurous because that was the high school coaches. And so there are players from our high school team who went off to Notre Dame and Harvard and all these good places to play sports later. The university brought some pretty good athletes because it was Division II, and so a lot of the coaches and the parents had kids in the schools, and so they were often pretty good athletes too. So I would say for a little town, the sports teams were decent.
All right. Now, our guest this morning is Charlie Cogan, part two. And Charlie is talking about growing up in Kirksville, Missouri. He works for a company called Crimson Education now. We talked all about that earlier. And he's a former Carleton College employee. And he's a member of the Northfield Rotary Club and a reader for the kids in the elementary schools. In high school now, this is my question I love to ask individuals that played sports. In high school, what's that one play that you'll never forget when you were playing for the Kirksville Tigers?
Unfortunately, it's not a good play. I think there was...
Well, in your mind.
We were playing against Centralia, and it was my senior year, and we were doing well. And the coach put me on their top scorer and said, shut him down. And he came to the lane three times in a row, and I stood my ground. And all three times they called a defensive foul on me, and he beat us on free throws. But I didn't actually feel like I had moved forward. I'd been standing. But I think he was one of these smart players who would bump into me and then fall down as if he had been hit by a truck. And so it was a frustrating. So I replay that in my dreams sometimes and think maybe if I just hadn't guarded him so close, we would have won that game.
Was he successful in his free throws?
Yeah, he made all of the free throws, and so he lost by 1 point. So
I can see why you remember that.
Yeah, that was a bummer. And there was actually the coach of the University of Missouri was a guy named Norm Stewart, who took them to the Final Four several times, and his son was playing on that team. And we handled him well, and we handled the other guy well, but for some reason in the last 2 minutes, I guess I blew my assignment.
And what was it like in the locker room afterwards?
I think it was pretty quiet.
Anybody blame you?
I think, actually, we had other opportunities to win that game. I remember I actually passed it to somebody under the basket who missed a two-footer. So I think I blamed myself, and then they said, we all screwed up.
It's a team.
It's a team, yeah. You go up, you win together, you screw up together, but we tried.
All right.
We never didn't try.
Okay, now, when you were in high school, did you have the job?
My first job was at Dairy Queen, so I'm always... trying to convince my kids that they need to get some good fast food jobs, but so far they've done other things.
Was that a sissy job or was
no
it
no
a,
it was okay. But it was a really tough job because they always wanted me to work. It was during the summer, and they always wanted me to work in the middle of baseball. So I ended up having to quit baseball because I'm the oldest of six. And my father said, at this point in time, I'd like you to buy your own shoes and do a few other things because we've got littler kids who need some resources. And even though he was a college professor with six kids, you have to be a little bit more. So I ended up dropping out of baseball and then moving into tennis because it was much more flexible. I could play when I wanted to. And we had a good tennis team, and we ended up actually going to state in tennis. But
I asked Howard Cosell one time what he thought was the toughest sport, and he said tennis. And it surprised me until I learned he told me why. Tennis is tough.
It's hot, too. You're always playing in 100-degree weather, and you're...
Yeah.
All by yourself,
in
unless
Missouri.
You've got a doubles team, right? Yeah.
So what was the favorite thing they ordered at Dairy Queen?
Well, I think people just love ice cream. And and unfortunately, I never made it that high in the hierarchy. I was on the grill. So,
yeah.
So
on the grill.
On the grill, yeah. I would be making it.
That must have been a relatively new Dairy Queen then.
It was. It was a Dairy Queen Brazier.
And yeah.
It was a kind of a flagship. When I was a kid, we used to go eat there, and we loved it. And then when I worked there, they worked hard. But the attractive women worked on the ice cream side. And that seemed to really be better for business than having a bunch of us greasy-looking guys, who had just gotten done mopping up French fry grease. And so I think it worked out well. They had the division of labor worked out that for sales that was perfect, but for the work it was a little tough.
Did you ever have the responsibility of changing the grease?
It's scary.
And pour it in a bucket with water was on the bottom?
We didn't pour it in a bucket with water because that would crackle like heck. What we had to do is drain it and filter it. And I was always worried because sometimes a little grease would get on the floor and you're holding this vat of boiling grease and you think, if I fall down, I'm dead, But never did, knock on wood. But
I made the mistake of doing that.
I can imagine.
The grease just comes bubbling out.
It came bubbled right back out, yeah.
And that's hard to clean up.
Yeah.
Did you master the little swirl on the top of the cone?
In my free time. We weren't allowed up there during work hours, but I think we did occasionally sneak over and get an ice cream cone. If we'd worked really hard, they'd kind of let us have a pass on that.
Okay. So how far did you live from the high school?
We lived on the other side of town, so we were on the north side of town. I would say about 2 or 3 miles.
Okay. So did you ever take the bus, walk?
Yeah, we took the bus. We took the bus for years, and we took the bus to different schools. I think we always had a bus.
Did you get your driver's license as quickly as you could?
16. So as fast as I could. I didn't have a car, but I was able to borrow the family car once in a while.
What kind of a car would that have been?
My father worked for the state of Missouri for the university, and so he said the best maintained cars in town were the state cars. So he'd buy these crusty looking old state cars that had 200,000 miles on them. He said they've never missed an oil change. They've never missed repairs because they belong to the state. And he'd buy them at a pretty good rate, and so we had two or three of those.
Oh, really?
And he would drive them for another 200,000 miles. So my sisters were a little bit more proud, and they would ask to be dropped off before school because they'd want to see have people seen them getting out
yeah,
of
a
rust bucket. You know, they'd say, "Why don't you can just let me go here, Dad. I'll walk the other half mile." So.
That continues today, I'm sure.
Yeah, my own kids do that to me now because I have a beat-up old minivan, so that's set to life, you know.
What? So did you have your own car in high school?
No, never.
Oh.
I didn't have my own car until I was 26.
Really?
Well, at Carleton, you weren't supposed to have a car. We did get together, about four of us got together, and my roommate's father owned a car dealership up in Highland Park. So we got together about $250 and bought a car, but it wasn't too much to look at. And we called it the Beast. It was a Plymouth Duster.
Oh.
And most of the dust was inside, but it was fun. We'd drive it once in a while, but it broke down so much.
I bet you'd love to have that car now.
Yeah, it probably would be worth more now than it was then.
Well, tell me how you chose Carleton.
I didn't choose Carleton initially because my mother had gone there, and so I had been for reunions, and I loved the campus. I think it was one of these places that you get there and you fall in love with it, but I wanted to go somewhere else, so I was looking at the East Coast. I'd lived there when I was little, and looking at different places, and I never applied to Carleton until at the end. I'd go to these places and visit, and my father would say, "Oh, yeah, Charlie's mom went to Carleton." They'd say, "Well, why are you visiting here? Carleton's a great school. You should just..." And little by little, it started dawning on me that I was being a little stupid. So I did eventually apply to Carleton, and it's a good place.
By the way, so people know, what year did you get out of high school?
78.
Okay.
And when I was 16 and I was first driving, my mother wanted to come to a reunion. So this is 1976. So I drove her up. Which was a harrowing experience in her car.
In the state car?
The old state rust bucket. And when I was here, there was a kid named Peter Nerum, and I ran into him out in the Bell Field. And so we went and played tennis for a couple hours, and I just had a great time. So I think that was the first time I'd actually been here when I was old enough to have fun on my own. And the college is much better now. They actually find fun activities for the kids when they come to visit. But in the olden days, I don't think they had quite as much infrastructure like that.
The olden days.
Right. I mean, 1970s, when we were all young.
The olden days.
Right, yeah.
My guest yesterday in 1972 today he's a Vietnam veteran.
Sure.
And first lieutenant on the ground in Vietnam.
Right, right.
Very, very interesting. It's a hectic time. And you, of course, are going through junior high and some high school. Just 1 year, because were you aware of the Vietnam conflict when you were in junior high and a freshman in high school, etc.?
In kind of a sad way, there was a building on campus called the Pershing Building. That's where my dad's office was.
Pershing?
Pershing, like John J. Pershing.
Yeah.
Because he's a graduate of Kirksville State Teachers College, you know, of all places. And so we would hang out there because my father taught there, and we'd go down and play in the gym and things like that. But there was a Hall of Fame wall. And you'd go and see all the Hall of Famers from the football teams. And what I found pretty sad was that when you looked at those Hall of Famers, a lot of them died in Vietnam because they were big and strong and, you know, patriotic, and they really wanted to do the right thing. But warfare had changed so much that being big and strong and fast and everything else didn't necessarily guarantee you'd come out alive. I mean, I think it was a tough war. And so I remember thinking, my gosh, you know, I think there were 15 or 20 trophies on the case. And about seven of them had died in Vietnam. You could see the year they died. And they had a special exhibit for them, too.
21 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. And when you drove into Northfield in the state car, how far of a drive? Was that about, like, 6 hours?
Yeah, and they didn't have Highway 35 back then.
Oh.
In the olden days.
What do you mean?
Or maybe we couldn't find 35.
We didn't have
GPS back then. But this is 1976.
Well, there was a 35 going south.
Okay. Was it? We used to go up Highway 63, which does make it to Minnesota. And then sometimes we always look forward to stopping at the Happy Chef in Albert Lee. Or the Happy Chef in Owatonna, or the Happy Chef. You know, there were Happy Chefs
everywhere.
Did
you push a little button?
I think I did, yeah. I think we usually had fun with those.
A late friend of mine arranged the giggle on that thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's a long story, but every time you say that, I think of my friend, my late friend Bob, and the button.
Yeah.
Yeah. But 35, I'm sure, went down into Iowa.
But it went down, went down to Kansas City. So my sense is probably back then, you know, in the olden days, it was going too much. It was too much to the side. So we would come straight up 63 and then maybe hit 218 at some point and then come up that way. So, but I was only driving that one summer. I just remember not being very attentive and almost going off the road a couple times. And my mother was impressed that I was able to wrestle it back onto the road. But I can imagine she probably aged about 2 years in that one drive. So, but the campus was beautiful, and I remember having a much different experience at the age of 16 on campus than I had had before.
You drove up here when you were 16.
Right, right.
In a state car with your mom in the passenger seat with no seat belts.
No, she had seat belts.
Oh.
And she was gripping the handrail pretty tight, too. Yeah.
First time you saw your mom?
Terrified.
Yeah, I was going to say speechless. We will take this break, and we will be back, and we will continue our conversation with Charlie Kogan.
Monster Energy AMA Supercross, an FIM World Championship. Witness an exhilarating sports story written in real time. A grueling battle of athleticism and determination that demands a lifetime of training to win, but only takes seconds to lose. Get your tickets today to see the world's best dirt bike riders race for the world's biggest title in your hometown. Tickets start at $15. Restrictions and additional charges may apply. Coming to U.S. Bank Stadium February 9th. Visit supercrosslive.com.
Kind of funny, the first time I ever went to one of those world's toughest rodeos, and I've been around horses all the time, but when I got inside of the building, I was allergic. You know, it would make my eyes swell up and my nose run, and I'm going, wait a minute. So one time I was cleaning out a trailer, and the horses, of course, were outside and tied up, and I'm inside there working away, and all of a sudden my eyes started watering, and I started sneezing and all. So I'm only allergic to horses in confined areas. I don't know why I'm telling you that. Did you ever do horseback ride in Missouri?
We did. When we moved there as little kids, my parents were pretty nice, and so they took us out to a family that had horses out in the country, and we'd go riding, and we went for about 2 or 3 years. But I think the fastest we ever got to was a canter.
Yeah.
And it was actually a lot of fun. My sisters loved horses, and so they kept riding afterward.
Well, but, you know, you think of Missouri, you think of Jesse James.
Yeah.
Okay. So you drive your mom up here for a class reunion.
Right.
Where did you stay?
My gosh, I think we might have stayed in a little... Well, I think because it was for her reunion, we may have just stayed on campus. But sometimes when we would come up, we'd stay in Farmington. Back in the day, there weren't that many hotels in Northfield, and often they booked up. So I remember there was a little sort of pretty simple hotel in Farmington that we stayed in a few times, and then we'd drive back down.
Okay. Did you know at that time that Jesse James had visited Northfield?
You know, in 2000, I'd heard stories. Then? I'd heard stories, and so I knew that.
When you were a kid in school?
Well, when I was a little kid in school, I still had the North, you know, my family had been coming to Carlton for about 100 years by then. And so my great-grandfather, my grandfather, my mother. And so we'd heard the stories about Jesse James. And in fact, because we were in Missouri, Jesse James is the good guy. He's the Robin Hood figure. So
yeah.
So I heard a much different set of stories when I was in Kirksville, Missouri.
That's what I was wondering. And so now here's another thing. Because your family has gone to Carleton College for over 100 years, and you were looking at other schools, and you didn't want to do what Daddy and Mommy wanted you to do. You wanted to be independent and choose your own school. So which one did you choose before you came to Carleton?
You know, I looked everywhere. I looked at Ivy League universities, and I looked at the little, what do they call them, colleges that change lives, like Grinnell and Knox and Monmouth. And my father loved visiting these little colleges because he loved Division III sports, and so he'd bring us up and talk to the coach and watch the game, and it was actually fun to go to little campuses like that.
Yeah.
And I think we did a few trips to Chicago. To visit the University of Chicago and Northwestern, we went down to Washington University in St. Louis. Never off to the West for us, but that was just us. And I think I actually thought a lot of those places are good. I think there's so many good schools in this country that a person can be happy at any one of them.
So which one did you choose? Did you go to the college before you went to Carleton?
No, I came straight to Carleton.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I applied to Carleton a little bit late in the game because I'd sort of decided I was going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I started thinking it over and realized that, in fact, this is an awfully beautiful place.
Were you a good student in high school?
I was a good student, but in my hometown, I would say that there was more of a premium on children should be seen, not heard. And I would say that we, because we asked a lot of questions, would be seen as good students by some teachers and as annoying by others. So I would say that the grades, you know, were always A's and B's, but not always A's.
So when you apply late to a school like Carleton, that generally has
It wasn't after the deadline. It was just, you know, sort of near the deadline.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I'd gotten other applications off 2 months earlier, okay. But then I got things off.
So then how did that work? That back in the old days, now you're talking
We sat on a typewriter, which is these things that don't, you know.
Folks, if you're just tuning in, Charlie Cogan thinks 1975, 76 are the old days. Okay. Please continue.
Right. I mean, back in the horse and buggy days.
Yeah.
No, we actually had to sit in front of these thing called typewriters,
mm-hmm.
and peck away at the keys. And if you made a mistake, you had to get a big bottle of whiteout out and fix it. And if you made a lot of mistakes, you just had to start over.
Okay.
And so I remember we got the application together, and I had a hard time because my father is a New Yorker and my mother's from the Midwest. So if I asked for advice on my essays, they'd give me opposite advice. So I remember I showed my essays to my dad, and he said, "You're applying to good schools, and there are 1,000 good students. They've all got the same grades you've got. They got the same testing you've got. And these essays are not going to pop out and give you any advantage at all. They're just going to go right to the back of the pile." And my mother would look at them and say, "Oh, those look fine." So I finally rewrote my essays to make my father happy, because I thought he he looked at the essays and he said, "You know, I really feel bad about this, because I'm the one who gave you the advice. But looking at these essays, I'm your dad and I don't even like you." Because they were trying to, you know, they're too self promoting. So I think it's hard. I don't know what the secret is for kids.
And what did you end up doing? Which essay?
I wrote an essay about how reading comic books had made me the intellectual that I was.
What was your favorite comic book?
I think I liked Iron Man.
The Iron Man?
Iron Man, yeah. Okay. Iron Man was good. But I liked Spider Man. I liked Doc Savage. You remember Doc Savage?
I am, let me see if I can recall the comic books that I read, okay? Superman.
Sure.
Plastic Man.
Uh-huh.
The Judds.
The Judds I don't know as well.
Little Lulu.
Okay.
Tubby was in that one. Captain Marvel.
Yeah, Captain Marvel was good stuff.
I think that's the Shazam.
Yeah.
And he was a kid on crutches selling newspapers.
Right, I think you're right.
Okay.
I think there was something a little bit like that with Thor, too.
Yeah, and then there was Black Hawk, I think,
mm-hmm.
and it was more like Army.
I could imagine that, sure.
Yeah, and I always thought that was a little bit above all the rest of them.
Because it was telling some real-life stuff.
Yeah, it was. You're familiar with
it? I don't know that one as well, but I've heard of it.
Popeye?
Yeah.
I like Popeye.
I just watched the Popeye cartoons. Yeah.
Mutt and Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
These are all familiar?
Oh, they're all familiar, sure.
Okay.
I think they'd made it to the newspapers by then, but...
And Tin Can Alley?
Yeah, that one I haven't read, but I've heard of it.
Well, here's the deal. The first radio station I worked at, the alley behind the building was Tin Pan Alley.
Okay.
Because the guy that did Tin Pan Alley was from Tomah, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so they dedicated the alley to Tin...
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, nice.
And I can't think of any others, but what I'm wondering then, today when you apply for colleges,
sure.
Not only do you have your scores and all of that stuff, but you do have to do an essay about how you want to help humankind. Did you have to do that back in the old days in 1975, 6, 7, 8?
You did, and you had to talk about your most meaningful activity. I would say that when I was writing those essays, if I were to go back and read them now, I probably would not be that excited. But, I mean, I think my most meaningful activity was scoring baskets in basketball or something. It wasn't helping anybody else, maybe the team. But so I think one of the things I always try to keep in mind is that we're all the product of our experiences to a certain point. And then as you go on through life, you have more experiences, you have a lot more to draw on. So some of my colleagues would get a little bit disdainful of the essay about a person who had gone on a mission trip and said, the people are poor, but they're happy. And I can see why, because in a way that's not much of an insight. But if it's your first trip ever, I suppose that's the first step. And you only get a little bit more sophistication when you've done things like that more often, right?
Now, were you a Boy Scout?
I tried. I got to Wiblos. And Wiblos is not very high. And we did camp.
Isn't that Cub Scouts?
It's high Cub Scouts. It's like the bridge between Boy Scouts and we did some camping trips, and there were certainly, I had classmates who became Eagle Scouts, and at the time I didn't appreciate how much work that is.
So you didn't write that in your application.
It was not in my resume.
Yeah. Okay. What did your, you said your grandfather went there. Did your great-grandfather go? You said they, 100 years of.
My great-grandfather graduated in 1887.
Wow.
And he became a country doctor in Mantraville, Minnesota, down next. His house was about 100 yards from the Hubble House.
Yeah, off of 52, and then you go in.
If you ever go to the Hubble House, and they have the house, the Wall of Pioneers.
Yeah.
And on that Wall of Pioneers, he and his two brothers owned a lot of grain mills down there, and they were doing really well. And then I think the state industry became a lot of grain mills, and theirs were not any better than anybody else's. And so they've sort of faded from being big-time grain mill operators. But because my grandpa had gone to Carleton and then off to the University of Minnesota for medical school, he was able to make it. And there's a really nice article in the archives. Dodge County has a really nice archive for the things, and it was talking about the fact that when the Mayo brothers wanted to put together an exhibit for country medicine, rural medicine, in 1932 for the World Fair, they knew my great-grandpa, so they said, would you be willing to dress up like a country doctor and carry the bag and be at our exhibit? And so he actually, that was in his obituary, that's a picture, because it looks so nice. I'm not sure he ever wore anything quite that cool when he was doing his work, but
were you ever? Did he live long enough to?
He died in the 1930s. He died in the 1930s, okay. So I never got to meet him. I got to know my grandpa well.
So, and he went to Carleton.
He went to Carleton for 2 years, and then he went off to serve in the Marines in World War I.
Oh boy!
And when he came back, he said the students here were all too young. I mean, I think he just went through enough stuff, and so he finished up at the University of Minnesota.
Okay, so that's your great-grandfather.
My great-grandfather is the one who was a country doctor.
Yeah.
My grandfather is the one who finished up at the University of Minnesota after World War I.
Your great-grandfather didn't go to Carleton?
My great-grandfather went to Carleton.
And he became a doctor.
And then he became a doctor.
Okay.
His son, my grandfather.
Yeah.
And actually in World War I, my great-grandfather was a captain as a doctor, but he was serving up in Sault Ste. Marie or something, just, you know, checking, you know, helping people when they came back from war and things like that. So he never left the country. My grandfather left the country with the Marines. And then he came back, worked for Hercules Power Company with the Cleveland Cliffs Mines in Ishpeming, Michigan, for most of his career. That's where my mother was raised, up in Ishpeming, right outside of Marquette.
But none of your heritage lived in Northfield.
No, they came to school here and then went on somewhere else. And then my mother actually loves Northfield, but she came to Carleton, went off to Columbia, where she met my dad in New York City.
Is she still with us?
She is. She's 83, going on 84, and she's a pillar of strength.
Really?
Well, you know, but she's certainly 83.
I mean, is she ambulatory? And,
yeah, she gets around. She gets around. She's
cognitive.
Still, she still works. She's a poet, and she also still works as a chaplain at the University of Iowa Hospitals.
Does she ever visit you and your
family? Oh, of course, yeah.
Well, let's have her on as a guest.
Why not? Why not? She'd be a great guest. She's much more articulate than I am.
Well, no, I'm just, she sounds like an interesting background.
She is.
We're going to take our final break this hour on the Wayne Eddy Affair, reminding you that Charlie Cogan is my guest for the second time. He works with international education with a company called Crimson Education. Is that correct?
That is.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Bandel, social worker at Three Links. Being a caregiver to someone who has a form of dementia can be exhausting. Finding social support is one of the best ways you can cope. At Three Links, we host caregiver support meetings. Facilitated by Three Links social workers, the meetings are tailored to your questions. Join us the second Wednesday of each month from 4 to 5 p.m. at Three Links Care Center. Call 664-8865 or find out more at threelinks.org.
Are you tired of that icky old shower, crumbling old tile, or outdated bathtub? Rebath can help in as little as one day. Rebath is locally owned and would be glad to meet with you for a free estimate. Call us today at 1-800-BATHTUB to turn that old bathroom into new.
5 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair, my guest this morning on KYMN Radio is Charlie Cogan, and this is the second time I've invited Charlie to be my guest, and I want to reiterate that if Grandma comes to visit your children and you and your wife, I would really enjoy talking to her. She would have been a grade schooler during the Second World War.
Right.
And those are the olden days, not the 70s.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because we have this beautiful Veterans Memorial in Northfield.
Yep, my wife has a brick there with Oscar Detley, who served in the Army during the Second World War.
Well, my mother's big brother, or little brother, baby brother, Eugene, was named William Eugene Holton, died in the Pacific Theater during World War II. So we put a paper for him, and then my mother was trying to remember his wife, because her name was Mary Linseth, and she married into my grandmother's side of the family, and she moved back to Hayfield, Minnesota, and we finally actually found where she lived for many years, and I wasn't able to connect with her before she passed.
Did she have a horse farm?
I'm sure she had some wonderful things. She had gone to Carleton for a couple of years and then transferred up to the University of Minnesota. No relation to my direct side of the family, but...
Well, how often does Mom come up?
She comes up every year for reunions because she said she'll know somebody somewhere within that five-year range. And so she likes coming to Northfield, so she'll come up for...
With you guys?
She stays with us for a while, and then she usually stays on campus, too.
Okay.
Yeah, but she'll stay with us maybe the day before and the day after.
Well, perhaps maybe you can then give her a call, let her know.
Of course.
Have her listen on KYMN.
Well, she listened. She listened to the segment from last week.
Yeah.
She said she enjoyed it, and then she corrected me on a couple of things. But otherwise,
isn't that the truth?
Her name is Nancy Adams Cogan, so she's a nice lady.
What did you say?
I said, "Oops." I think I said that she started Head Start when we were little. And she said when we were little, there were still other younger kids. So she was a substitute teacher with young kids and homebound kids when we were little. Mm-hmm. And then when I went off to college, there was actually enough room in her life to become a full-time Head Start teacher.
It amazes me how many times I'll have somebody come back for part two, and they'll tell me generally off the air that, oh, boy, my wife really got mad because I didn't mention
I
got that wrong, and you missed one of your grandchildren and hurt her feelings or whatever.
Yeah.
So be sure to do that because I love to talk to women and men that were, you know, that are older in their 80s, 90s, you know, and relive what it was like. Back in the olden days, I can call them. You'd call them ancient days, I suppose. 2 minutes before 10 o'clock, my guest on KYMN Radio, Charlie Cogan. And Charlie, when you decided that you were going to come to Northfield and go to Carleton, were your relatives that are Carleton people, like your mom, et cetera, really excited and give you a lot of advice?
Yeah, they gave me advice. What I have to say is my mother never pushed Carleton. She always was very relaxed about it, which kind of made me decide that I should look a little closer, because she never said, why aren't you applying to Carleton? She said, oh, you've made some good choices. And I started thinking, well, what's the matter? You don't think I'd get in or what? You know, and so little by little, I started thinking maybe I should look at this place because of the quiet coming from her end.
Do you think that having relatives, heritage at Carleton College helped get you in? Because it is hard to get in.
You know, I don't know. I've been doing admissions work for 22 years, and I know that no university would ever want to be meaner to its own alumni than they are to the general public. But I think we're also aware of...
More what?
We would never want to be tougher on our own alumni than we would be on the general world at large.
So you have a preference.
No, what I'm saying is we wouldn't want to be tougher. At the same time, if you take a student who's never set foot at Carleton, they're going to be an alumnus when they graduate, right? So you want to respect the students and the families who've got a strong connection to the college, but you also want to make sure you're always bringing in students who have no connection, because that's what keeps you growing.
Sure.
And it's a little bit like immigration. You know, you want to make sure that the people who are already here do well. That doesn't mean that some new people wouldn't bring new skills and new ideas and new perspectives.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock here and looking at the fact that we're bouncing into the 10 o'clock hour, and I thought I'd take a break, and I'm going to play a theme song here that I use during the regular broadcast for the second hour, And I thought that, and usually I got a newscast here, and people like yourself and myself can get up and walk around and get something to drink or whatever. Right. So we're going to play a song, okay. And it's by the Beatles, and it's from the olden days.
The olden days.
Oh. Well, based on your thoughts about
it's all relative, right?
1967, this was a hit. Hey, that must mean the end right there on KYMN Radio, Northfield, Minnesota. Broadcasting live from our studios on Division at 2nd, across the street from the Carnegie Library. And we are enjoying an overcast day, a Tuesday. Feels like Monday, but it is already a Tuesday, January 22nd, and the year is 2019. For those of you that may be listening to this sometime in the far future, children and potentially grandchildren of my guest, Charlie Cogan, and we're sharing his years, and we got him out of high school, and now we have him into Carleton College. And what's your, how did they, your folks drop you off here in 1978, the fall of 1978, and they drove up in the old state car.
They did. And did
any of your siblings come with?
Yeah, one of my younger siblings, the baby, whose name is Caitlin,
yeah,
was about 4 years old at the time, and
okay.
She came along.
All right, mom and dad,
yeah.
And Caitlin and you.
And so they had a little bit of stuff that you could do with your parents, and then I didn't want them to leave at first because I kind of started feeling as if I was in a new place, and I think I tried to give my dad a hug, and he said, you know, you're my son. You don't need to give me a hug. I know you love me. I thought that was a little standard. Well, you know.
Yeah. Well, my dad didn't do hugs at all.
Right, right.
One time I was almost falling asleep when I was about 6 years old, and my cousins lived with us, and they would kiss dad goodnight.
Right.
And I'd kiss mom goodnight. And I went over to my dad to give him a kiss goodnight. Hey, pushed me away and said, men don't kiss each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go. Lessons that you learned in childhood.
See how I remember that? Isn't that crazy how you remember something so far back?
Anyhow,
you were getting a little homesick as a car.
Right. But the good thing is that the college has they're kind of used to that. So they actually had a scavenger hunt. And because I'd been on campus before, I was really good at the scavenger hunt. So we were all running around trying to find things. And by the time the evening was over, I was fine with hanging out with my new friends. And so I think it was...
What is this? Be more detailed. I guess I'm not familiar with that.
They wanted you to find different things on campus. And so I remember there were things that I knew and things that I didn't. But because I'd been on campus a few times before, I could find Sales Hill or I could find the chapel. You know, just basic things. And I think you would get in a group of people from your floor and you had to try to race around and find all these things and then check them off and then get back by a certain time to win. And I don't think we won, but I think we did okay, and we had fun in the process.
Oh, so they gave you a list.
Right, and then you have to find all these things. So it's sort of a scavenger hunt.
Yeah, and then check
them off. Where is the Stonehenge in the Arboretum? So, you know, got all these people wandering around the woods trying to find the little Stonehenge thing, and then, you know, where is the telescope on campus? And so you have to find the planetarium or whatever.
Did they send you across the street to see the athletic, but the soccer field, football field, and the men's gym? And
the West gym. Sure. And then Cowling used to be the women's gym when I was here, so that may not be long ago, but it was still the women's gym. And we played our games in the West gym, and the women actually at least practiced in Cowling.
Now, speaking about games, did you know that you were going to play, or did you have to try out? And was basketball ever mentioned before you even signed on to go to Carleton?
You know, my father knew Jack Thernblad.
Okay.
Only because they'd come up and watch games, and my father just loved to talk basketball. So he knew Jack. Jack hadn't seen me play. And I think we did include an article of me from the local paper that I'd scored 20 points or something with the application, just to show that I might be at least somebody who could be a little bit useful.
Okay.
I scored my 20 points against a little weaker opponents than some.
Yeah.
So I think, no, there was never any guarantee. I think when we got to campus, usually what they would do is the captains would run practices during the fall, and the coach wouldn't really be there that much. He might come by and take a look once in a while, but I remember working
like
out
rules?
There might have been. I'm not sure what it was, but back then we had a JV, so it was sort of fun. I mean, you had 30, 40 players showing up and playing, and eventually maybe the ones who didn't seem like they could compete would just say, well, I guess I'll do something else. But we still had 25 or 30 players by the time it shook out, so we had a varsity and a JV, and I think that's been one of the losses, because you really don't know who's going to be great at the age of 18. I mean, you can do a better job of guessing when people are 18 than you can when they're 20 or 20 or when they're 14, because you don't know who's going to grow. But I think the athletic budgets are like every other budget. They have to be tight, and so the junior varsity programs were sort of eliminated.
Well, when you came to Carleton, it was the fall of 78.
Yeah.
And did you were they still in the Midwest Conference?
We were. We played we played against Cornell College and Knox and
Monmouth
and Ripon and Beloit and all those places. The University of Chicago was in our conference.
Did you go to the football games?
I went to the I had a lot of I went to the games because I had a lot of friends playing football. I actually was jealous because you had Bubba Sullivan coaching, and Bubba's a great coach. And I'd quit football under a different kind of regime down in Kirksville. And coming here, I actually thought he ran a really classy program.
So did you go out?
I didn't. I ended up playing rugby instead in the fall.
And it takes leather balls to play rugby.
It does. It takes a lot of things.
Whereas pigskin for football.
Right. No, it's true. But I think the program for football was great. There were a couple of the players who I have known, kept in touch with ever since. So if I could go back and do it again, the only thing is that was also soccer season. And when I was in the Peace Corps later, I fell in love with soccer. But that was never an option. We didn't have soccer in my hometown in Missouri back in the young days.
Was Mike Barnes the quarterback?
Bill Ford was the quarterback when I was there. He was a freshman, left-hander. He just got inducted into the Hall of Fame last year. And his brother came and gave a sort of a talk for him and said, you know, there are just people with ultimate talent who you just know they're going to go somewhere. And they, you know, they, and he said, you know, that was never my brother. He got cut from ninth grade football, but he eventually stuck with it and got better. And actually, Bill was a good, just one of those people who didn't give up and really wanted to win.
I think KYMN Radio was carrying Carleton football at that time.
Sure.
And Dan Freeman would
ride
the bus with the players to go to Northwestern.
Right.
And
sure.
So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, of course.
For the station to carry Carleton football. And Bob Sullivan was just a great guy. Great guy who wrote a book.
He's still a great guy.
Yeah. The last time I saw him, he was still Bob, you know, looking good.
And
he's an old St. Paulite, you know, because he coached at Hill Murray.
Sure.
So that's pretty interesting that you came up for that, and you start hanging right away. Who was your – how many guys to a – where was your dorm and how many people in – a room?
I think the year that I came, we had a big yield on the offers. So you make offers to maybe twice as many people as you need, expecting about 40% to say yes.
In regards to what?
Well, when you make offers to freshmen, you say, let's say we need 500. So you admit 1,000.
Oh.
Because people have good choices, right? So you're going to admit people who decide to go to the University of Minnesota because it's cheaper. You decide to, or bigger. Or they go off to the University of Wisconsin, or they go off to Harvard or something, or they go to St. Olaf because they love the Olies. And so what happens is not everybody you admit comes. So I think the year that I came, the admit offers were generous and the yield was strong. So there were actually too many of us. And so I was in a triple that was usually a double.
In what hall?
In Goodhue. It's right out on the edge of the forest, right?
Okay. Which now is a big sporting complex.
Yeah, now it's primetime real estate. If you're an athlete, why wouldn't you want to be 10 feet from where you're working out? But back then it was right next to the Arboretum, which is, we still had Northern Lights back in the old days.
Wow. Did you ever spend time at the observatory?
I did. They used to let us in my first term freshman year. I took a class in astronomy with a guy named Matthews, who is actually supposed to be a brilliant astronomer. And the class was fairly routine, pretty challenging. I think I survived with a B-, but we did get to go up and climb up in that beautiful observatory and look at the planets, and it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I interviewed the guy that was running that many years ago, and he offered to have me come over. I have never been in it.
Right.
In all the years I've been here, and I got the app on my phone that will tell me what stars I'm looking
at. Right, right.
So I finally figured out what this one big shining star is that I see all the time.
What is it?
Uh-oh.
Sirius, right?
Yeah. It was either Jupiter
or Venus.
Or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Jupiter or...
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's one that is real bright and it has little red...
Right.
That every once in a while you can see red.
Okay.
High in the east.
Okay.
Southeast sky.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know.
We'll get an astronomer on here for next week, and we'll get it all figured out.
The only one thing I know is Frank Sinatra.
Right.
Fly Me to the Moon.
Right.
And so anyhow, I show my ignorance doing that. 13 minutes after 10 o'clock on KYMN Radio out of Northfield, Minnesota. Thanks for crossing us on 1080 Radio. A lot of people twist their dial to find out what stations are doing. You have landed at 95.1 FM or 1080 AM. Our studios are live out of Northfield, downtown Northfield, and we're happy to have you with us. My guest this morning is a Carleton College grad, Charlie Cogan, and we're talking about what it was like to come to Northfield for the first time, 3 to a room. And did you get along with your roommates, and where were they from?
Well, one of them was from Minneapolis at the Blake School, and one was from Highland Park and had gone to high school in that area. And, we got along well. The good thing about Goodhue back in that time is that it was a little bit isolated, especially when the winter hit. And so you got to know each other better because you didn't want to have to walk across the tundra to see other people. And so you'd actually really get to know the people in your dormitory. And it was, our floor was full of interesting people.
Yeah, and, of course, the food service was excellent, wasn't it?
I mean, we had food at Goodhue back then. The first week we got there, Animal House had just come out. And so we started a food fight, and that ended quickly and badly. But
Were you involved?
Oh, yeah. I thought it was going to be a great idea, but apparently you get in trouble for those things.
Yeah, did you
We had to clean it up.
Did you have to go see Casey Jarko?
You know, Casey Jarko was still going strong at that point, but we had David Appleyard was the dean of students, and he had a guy named Bruce Walters, who was much bigger and huskier.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't get to paddle us like we got in Missouri, but he gave us pretty good consequences that made us not want to have a food fight again.
When did you settle down and realize that this is a really important part of my life and I got to get good grades and pay attention and not get in trouble?
Well, actually, when I first got here, I was aware of the fact that I was surrounded by students who probably had better grade points and at least the same testing and, you know, more honors and awards. And so I worked my butt off my first term and got really good grades, mostly because I was trying to prove that I actually belonged here. And then once I figured out I was okay, then I started goofing around. So, but I would say in general, the first year went well. The spring term, I had a chance to study abroad. And as the oldest of six, we didn't have a lot of extra travel money. So I took that opportunity to go to the Po program in southern France. And that was wonderful. That was incredible. And my French went from terrible to mediocre, which was a big improvement at that point.
What is the purpose of those trips? They can be very expensive for people that can afford it and perhaps scholarships for those that can't that are outstanding. What's the whole purpose? How long were you there?
I think they get you out of what you're used to. So I think what happens is I grew up in a small town in Missouri. It's a wonderful place. I've been to big cities in the United States, but I'd never been to a place where people spoke a different language and where that language was valued. So I always find myself trying to convince my kids that they should study French or Spanish because it's important to know another language, and they don't buy into it until they've actually traveled. And then when you leave and you're surrounded by people speaking another language with different way of looking at things, I think it makes you more flexible. And there are plenty of quotes saying that if you haven't left home, you won't really know where you're from. But when you come back, you see things differently. So I think it can be really transformative.
How long were you there?
Oh, 4 months.
4 months?
4 months.
Did you live with a family?
I did. I lived with one host family who I think thought that they were going to make a profit on it, and they weren't making much of a profit. So they decided.
How does that work?
It wasn't very good. They're very nice, but I think the amount of money that the college would give for a host family would be basically so you don't lose money. But I think they had rented rooms to other people, and then they were kind of thinking of that as my deal too. And so they, for example, said, you can't wash your clothes here because it's too expensive. Go down the street to the laundry, or, you know, whatever they call it, the lavanderie, and they'll wash your stuff for you. And I went down, and it would have been all the money I had in my pocket to just wash one load of clothes. So I started washing my clothes in the sink, and they got mad at me. So eventually the college got me out of there and put me in the house of a professor who was teaching for the program, who was a very nice, eccentric guy. He actually had about three or four goats living in this walled house, and all of these aunts and uncles would come by and visit him. And it was like Dr. Doolittle or something. And that was just temporary. So I lived there for about 2 weeks, and it was actually fun, but also strange because I wasn't used to having goats walking in and out of my room at night. And eventually they put me in the home of a woman who said, sure, I could take a second student. And she had lived in Canada for years and years, named Madame Grassi, Raymond Grassi. And she already had another Carleton student, but she put me in the other room. And she had just lost her husband the year before. And she was just a very, very wonderful woman. And so we kept in touch with her all the way up until she was in her 90s. And I think I visited her for the last time in 2006, and she passed away the next year. But really fascinating.
You went to France and visited her.
Yeah, well, when I was in Europe, I would just swing down
because your job takes you over.
Right, right.
Okay. So did she come home with a bag of groceries with a loaf of bread hanging out of it?
She would have done that, but it turned out that she owned a pastry shop, and so she had bread. And she learned fast enough not to let me run the pastry shop. Yeah. She'd say, well, I'm going to go out shopping. Would you run the pastry shop? And then she'd come back, and all of the strawberry tarts were missing, but, you know, things like that. But wonderful.
Well, was a bakery shop attached to her
home? The apartment, yeah. She lived in the back. I think what happened is
Give a similar, like using downtown Northfield.
It's almost as if you were to go into a place. I'm trying to think of a place like that. There are houses like that in Northfield. I think there's a new orthodontist in town. It's called Chic Orthodontics.
Highway 3.
Right. And I think what they did is they built the office, but then they also built a little apartment right nearby so they can live there. And I think it would be like that. You know, you'd come into the pastry shop, which was beautiful and classical with the newspapers and things like that. And then at the end of the day, you'd go in and you had the kitchen and then you had rooms upstairs. And so she kind of had either owned or bought that little storefront along with the rest of the place.
It must have smelled good all the time.
It smelled really good. And she was actually a wonderful person. She named her dog after me. She had a dog named Charlie. And I'd walk the dog for her, and then she made me carry a bag to pick up the poop. And it was, we'd never, in Missouri, we didn't pick up the poop. We figured it was fertilizer. But
yeah.
But in Paris, apparently, or in France, you can get in big trouble.
Were you in?
No, this was in the south, in Po.
Okay.
Have you ever read The Three Musketeers?
Have I ever heard of them?
Yeah, I've heard of them.
I've tasted them. Boy, they're delicious.
Yeah.
I know who you mean.
Well, the hero, the young guy named D'Artagnan, was from that area.
Oh?
The Gascons. They're pretty tough and stubborn. They speak French with a Spanish accent.
Were you able to communicate then with the French that you started off with and then completed?
I had 2 years in high school in Missouri.
Yeah.
And one term with Kathy Andel, who's still teaching at Carleton.
Okay. So
I would say my French was pretty bad. When I first got to France,
yeah.
We went to the Cathedral of Notre Dame, and we didn't see Quasimodo, but we went and visited the Cathedral of Notre Dame.
Did you go through all the way up to the top?
Yeah, we did, but I really had to go to the bathroom, and so I was going around asking for, excusez-moi, est-ce que vous avez une salle de bain? Which sounds perfect if you're studying French in Kirksville, Missouri. It means, do you have a bathroom? But in the French, there's a word called WC. It's just water closet. The way the English call it. And so they didn't know what the hell I wanted. Why do you want to take a bath in my store? And so finally somebody took me by the hand and walked me over to the place that said WC, because I didn't know what that was. And then said, give a tip to the toilet paper guy. Because what happened when you went in, you had to give a tip and then get the toilet paper, go off and do your business, and then come back. And so it was kind of an interesting. I mean, cross-court, there. So 10 minutes into the trip, I was already failing miserably in my French. But
is that the... no tip, no wipe rule.
I think something like that. Yeah, it was. They did have you over a barrel for sure.
Oh, that's interesting. Did you use bicycles a lot?
We did. We had gitan, which apparently means gypsy in French. But we had gitan bicycles that were really nice, and mine got stolen.
Did you own it?
And then we didn't. No. We didn't own it. So I walked after that for a while until they got me another bicycle.
Well, whose bike was it?
It was I think Carleton bought them and then just had this fleet of bikes, which they would then either resell or move on.
Have them available. So they went to basically the same place year after year.
Right. I think what happened.
Different students.
Well, Po was an interesting place because it's right near the Pyrenees Mountains, and there was a big parachuting camp in town, and so they. The theory is that if you left your bike outside, some parachuter would come in town to have a drink and then would just grab the nearest bike and ride back to the camp and throw it on the ground somewhere out there. So I'm sure mine ended up serving somebody well.
At 23 minutes after 9 o'clock on KYMN Radio, my guest this morning is Charlie Cogan, and we're chit-chatting about his time abroad as a Carleton student in France. I've had the pleasure of traveling to France and staying there, and there's a lot of people that speak English.
Right.
But I think that I will know exactly how much I have in me because my wife gave me a gift of, you take a cotton, a Q-tip, and
right.
No, you spit into a little thing, and now I'm going to get the results of what.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice Christmas present, especially for my adopted daughter.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I believe I'm half French, all right? And I love the language.
Right.
I mean, I can't speak it, but I like the way I like it. Now, when you were taking French, you were probably learning where to put pronouns and adverbs and adjectives and sentence structure and all that, whereas you just want to be able to speak the language and
right.
ask where the bathroom is.
Then you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
We used to have to listen to radio, and there's something called Radio France International, Radio France Inter, and they would do a one-minute summary of all the news for the day. Boom, 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 boom. And so we were supposed to record that and then transcribe it. And I remember when Margaret Thatcher took over in England. There was aujourd'hui en Ursand on the pudding, gouvernement Callahan renversé par une voix près, Madame Maggie Thatcher, pomme de fer. And I thought, I have no idea what in the hell they kept talking about. But I tried to write that down the best they could, and then it turned out they were using a bunch of slang. So Ursan dan the pudding means today there is a muskrat in the pudding or something. I mean, who's going to figure out what that means? And so, or maybe a slug. And so, but we had fun, and we learned a lot. I mean, in 4 months, my French went from completely worthless to bad. So you know, I thought it was pretty good, but later, as my French got better, I realized that wasn't that good.
That's funny. Yeah. Completely worthless to bad. Yeah. 26 past or 25 past 10 o'clock on Kim. Tell me, did you have any opportunity to take the channel?
No, it didn't exist yet.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So we did take – I didn't go to England that time. I went to England later. But that time I got up to Paris. I went to Aix-en-Provence. I thought I had a friend there, but it turned out that she had changed to a different program. So I wandered the streets of Aix-en-Provence for about 2 days until I finally realized we didn't have smartphones back then. So I was just kind of asking around. It's a city of 100,000, so it wasn't going that well.
That's big. How far from Paris is that?
It's down in the sort of Côte d'Azur. It's down not too far from Saint-Tropez and all those fancy places where all the tourists go.
You mean where none of us know what you're talking about?
Right. It's down by Marseille.
If you wanted to go to Paris, how long would it take?
It would take you probably 3 hours or 4 hours on the train.
Okay. So
it's down on the southern part, right on the coast of the Mediterranean.
How about the food?
The food was incredible, of course.
Did you ever go to any of the high-end restaurants where they have five courses and waiters for everything?
No. My entire budget would have been about that much for 4 months. So.
Yeah. How about fast foods? Did they have American fast foods?
There were McDonald's and things like that, and I would say I maybe went once,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed self-defeating. The problem is sometimes you don't know what you're ordering. Did you ever see that movie, The Jerk, with Steve Martin?
I don't know.
Well, at one point he's made millions of dollars with something called the OptiGrip, which is a thing you can use to take your glasses off and put them back on. It's a funny movie.
Yeah.
But he takes his wife to a French restaurant and starts ordering things. And I had that kind of experience. I think I saw something that looked really cool, and it turned out it was kidneys. And I didn't like kidneys. And so, you know, I mean, it looked like a delicious meal. And when it came, I thought, what's that?
No.
Yeah, so that's life. You know,
disappointing, too.
Yeah, yeah.
When, I feel that way about, what is it, calamari or squid?
Yeah, calamari.
Thank you, calamari.
The good thing,
doesn't it sound good? Hey, would you like some calamari? Yes.
And then you can chew it for a long time, so that's good. Well, you get your money's worth.
I thought, you know, I could just take the tire off my bicycle and get the inner tube
right.
And cut it, and then...
then you could make it. You could stretch it a little bit.
And some people think it's really great.
Yeah.
I'm not into
it. It's an acquired taste.
Yeah.
If you.
So what about age and wine when you're over there as a Carleton student?
Well, there were no age limits, but I think my taste in wine was pretty poor. So I remember there was a local wine that's actually pretty famous called Joanson. And it's they have the dry one and the fruity one. And we were all 18, so we all wanted the fruity one.
Oh, they have an age limit then.
No, there was the fruity one. No, there wasn't any age limit. So we were able to drink, and I think... We had Joanson. Later on, I realized that the dry one is actually the one that's famous. The other one is just sort of like Boone's Farm apple wine,
okay.
Which to me sounded like the best wine ever. So, you know.
Tempo wine is fine.
Right.
Drink
right.
it when you dine. Remember that
right,
one?
Right, right. No, and my gosh, you know, looking back, if I could go back now and have access to that much beautiful, wonderful wine at that price, I would have had a much more cultured experience.
Did you get an opportunity to mix with Parisian or French students your age?
At the University of Pau in the South, we did.
Okay.
We actually took classes with our own professors, but we went to the dining hall at the university, and we got to know students. I mean, we were 18, 19 years old. I remember one of the most interesting experiences was there were a lot of Iranians studying.
A lot of what?
Iranians. From Iran, studying at the University of Pau, just like they were in my hometown in Missouri. It's back when the Shah was sponsoring a lot of students to study in the United States on the assumption that you bring students back and then they can take over all the high-tech jobs in the oil industry and things like that. And in my hometown in Missouri, I'd always gotten along pretty well with the Iranian students, but I think things had gotten a lot tenser in the couple of years right before that. So we were there in the spring of 79, right before the revolution. In Iran, And there was one Iranian student who was very friendly, and we always sit at lunch and talk, and some of his friends didn't like that. So I remember one time he and I were going and talking to the others and went to shake hands, and the guy tried to force my hand, like, you know, trying to force my hand down. And I'm a tennis player. I'm not super strong, but I just kind of held it there and then shook and then released. But I kind of sensed some hostility, and I think not being maybe the most acute person, I talked to the student who was a friend, and he always said, no, we have a good feeling about the United States, but obviously not everybody did. And I think a year later, that's when they had the hostage situation.
Well, one of the things that I wonder about is that the ugly American
of course.
Feeling that you had. Now, I never experienced that in my travels in Europe, but evidently it's alive and well. And except for Jerry Lewis, he gets along well, and he got along well. So you did have that experience?
Well, I don't think I was an ugly American. I was more just a naive American. But I would say that there were others in our group. You know, there's a lot of socioeconomic diversity. There were some kids in the group with us who probably came from wealthier families and may have had a little bit more of a sense of entitlement. And I remember one of them had a father who came over and visited and was bossing around the waiters and waitresses. And I thought, well, I could never do that even anywhere. You know, I could never do that because my sisters are waitresses. Why would I want to act like that? But so I think ugly Americans do exist, but I think ugly everybody exists.
Sure.
If you go anywhere, you'll find somebody ugly.
You know, the cab trip from the airport to the hotel in downtown Paris, well, one of the things that caught my attention early was various neighborhoods we were going through from very nice and some that were not nice at all. But the trains caught my attention because of the graffiti.
Right.
And I'm going, oh, it's international. I thought graffiti was Brooklyn, you know.
Or Northfield, if you've ever been stuck behind those trains that go by.
Oh, yeah, I always watch the graffiti, But there was a lot of it.
Yeah, a lot of it.
Yeah. So you had a great time, Eiffel Tower?
Yeah.
Louvre?
Yeah, and I tried to qualify for the French Open because I overestimated my tennis skills, and I played the number one player in southern France, and I was proud that I won a couple of points during the course of
tennis. How did that?
I won a couple of points. I only won one game out of the entire match.
How did you get involved?
I there was a tournament. You know, there are qualifiers because it is the French Open, so it's you go through different rounds of qualifiers.
That means anybody, anytime.
Right. Well, I think what happens is regionally you can do that, and then when you get to the tournament in Paris, you've already had to go through all of that. So then at that point, you weren't going to just cruise in and say, yeah, I'd like to play.
Yeah, okay. So you were doing a qualifying match.
Yeah, so I got destroyed. But it was fun. I've never had more fun losing badly.
Well, now, if you would have won and continued up the road,
it would have been big if because it was on clay.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
it was on clay. It was a much different game.
What would have happened? Would you be an American in the French Open, or would you be an American student, French Open?
That's a good question. It could have turned out to be a problem at some point because you're looking, it is the French qualifiers.
Yeah.
I don't think they thought of me as enough of a threat to be the winner.
Did that take a lot of guts to do
it
that?
It was fun. I enjoyed it. I played a couple of different players, and I beat a couple of people who were ranked maybe 50th in the area. And so I went, I was bragging, and they said, well, you should play this guy. And I played him, and it was a quick match. But
on clay.
Well, and every ball he hit landed within about 2 inches of the baseline. His name was Olivier Prel. And I think he was number 15 in France. So
Olivier Prel?
Yeah.
That real tall, short, fat, skinny guy with light, dark hair?
Yeah, with the curly hair, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We'll take a break, and we'll be back. Our guest this morning, having fun with Charlie Cogan, part two on the Wayne Eddy Affair on Kim, a friend you can count on.
Maintenance on your new car or truck. You don't just take your car into anyone. At Witt Brothers Service in Northfield, you know you found a name you can trust. To start, we're a Napa Auto Care Center, so the technicians we employ are experts trained in every aspect of your vehicle's maintenance. This gives you the peace of mind in knowing that everything we do is accepted under the terms of your manufacturer's warranty. Add to that the fact that we use quality Napa parts that meet or exceed original equipment and specifications. And you have the one place where you can entrust all of your vehicles. Come see Witt Brothers Service in downtown Northfield today.
We're downtown Northfield on this Tuesday morning, and the time here at Kim, a friend you can count on, is 10:34. The date is January 22nd, 2019. My guest this morning is Charlie Cogan. And Charlie, any other exciting things you did in France that are fun to talk about besides competing for the French Open? That's pretty good. And having goats walk into your bedroom.
When I went to Paris at the end of the stay, the French Open was actually going on, so I got to go watch it. And I had a couple of tennis rackets, and so I brought tennis rackets with me. And I tried to walk in the players' entrance, but they wouldn't let me do that. So, but they didn't take away my rackets. And so when I got inside, I walked over and hit a few tennis balls on one of the courts just for fun. I found somebody else who was actually a really good player and tried to survive 5 minutes so I'd have my 5 minutes of playing on the courts at Roland Garros.
Wow.
It was fun. It was fun.
So do you get graded on your overseas trips? Do they... What did they call it? Did they say you got an A in international?
Well, when I started doing the international travel for Carleton in 2000, the college only had about 15 or 20.
Now, you're talking as a professional. Now.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, for the study abroad, I ended up getting mostly Bs, but I think I made more progress than almost anybody in the program because when I went, I came back after that trip and I went to my old high school French teacher and I said, Madame Stacer, I'm here. I just wanted to tell you I just got back from France. And then I started speaking my bad French, and she said, Charlie, I don't speak French. And I said, well, you are a French teacher. She said, did you never notice that I just gave you homework and then told you to do it in class? When I got this job, I had to teach two languages, and my language is Spanish. And so I would speak in Spanish class, but in French class, I just know enough to grade the homework. And I thought, wow, no wonder I started out with such bad French. But anyway, really nice person.
Yeah. So. And there's a great similarity,
and
I like to say what I learned was Latin is the mother language.
Right, right.
And it's French and German and English and...
Portuguese.
Okay.
Italian.
Yeah, there's six, I think, all together.
I think Romanian, too.
No.
Romanian is a Latin language, but Bulgarian is Slavic.
No.
Yeah, I'd like to say I was able.
How would you know?
Because I went to Romania and I was hoping I could use my French, but I couldn't.
Oh, well, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, the Romanians speak a Latin-based language, whereas the Bulgarians and the Serbians. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
they don't teach that unless I missed it.
I think it was a province. You know, back in 280 AD, it was a province of the Roman Empire.
So oh yeah, I forgot about that.
The Dacians. I think they were called the Dacians.
So 4 months over, from when to when? What month to what month?
From March until June.
Okay, so when you got back to stateside, you were left the winter and came back in the summer.
And I was teaching tennis in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in a tennis camp.
Wait a minute. How did you report back to Carleton after a 4 month stay in France under a program provided by Carleton?
They didn't want to see me until the fall.
Because you mean it's like goodbye in March, and then, I'll see you next fall?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a Carleton professor along with us, and so he gave me my B minuses, and then we all left, and I actually spent 2 weeks traveling. There were probably 25 of us or 30 of us.
So he had a grade 25 people.
Yeah.
Okay. You must have really impressed him if he gave you a B.
B minus, yeah.
B minus.
Yeah, I got a B plus in one class. Well, I think... What I told them, I said, you have to look at my progress. When I came in, I was awful, and now I'm just mediocre.
Bad.
But mediocre is a lot better than awful. And I think he thought about it, and he said, yeah, that's probably a B. And so,
did people suck up to him?
I think he was a pretty interesting guy. His name was Bob Fields, and he taught. I think he ended up leaving Carleton to go teach at Hofstra University in New York afterwards. But
okay.
He had a beard, kind of. You remember Bluto from the Popeye?
Yeah.
He had one of those beards where if he shaved 5 minutes later, he had a full beard again.
Testosterone.
Must be that. Must be that. But I thought he was a good teacher.
Okay. Yeah. So you leave school in March to go overseas, and you don't come back until September.
Right.
And then you went to play tennis, teach tennis where?
It was called Camp Winnedoo for Boys in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, right up near where they have the Tanglewood concerts every summer. There's a sort of festival called Tanglewood. It's near the Berkshire Mountains.
I'm not familiar with that area.
It's a beautiful area, right near the border of New York.
How did you get the connection?
I looked in Tennis Magazine for tennis camp jobs just because I was missing the tennis season to go to France, and so I thought at least I'll try to keep plugged in and play over the summer.
So,
And my father, and I think, helped me to locate a couple of jobs, and I applied for one, and I went and interviewed in New York City with a crew cut.
In New York City?
Yeah, and it was in New York City. This is 1979, and the guy thought I was great, but I had a crew cut, and I didn't get my hair cut for 4 months. And when I came back, he was not very – I mean, he had a hairline like I do now. So I think he'd sort of resented that I had this big, huge mop of hair. He said, you look like one of those guys from Hair.
Oh, so you interviewed before you went to France.
Right, right. And I had the job lined up.
Okay, okay.
And then when I came back, I looked a little different.
Yeah.
And so he
– You didn't have a perm, did you?
No, no. But this is when John McEnroe was young.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I had John McEnroe hair. In fact, when I went to the French Open, I tried to pretend like I was John McEnroe, but I'm right-handed, so it kind of spoiled the effect.
So the hair that you don't have was curly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the hair I don't have now was curly back then.
Okay.
And so we spent, I think it was 2 months, teaching tennis and coaching baseball.
Who's we?
They had an interesting group of people. There were I think, about 10 or 15 tennis players. One coach from Northern Michigan brought his entire team. There was a Latin American player who was actually really, really good and played on clay. This was on clay courts. And then there were some of us who were pretty good tennis players. One or two of them are lifetime friends. One is a guy named Jonathan Chamaine, who I just saw when I was in New York City a couple of months ago.
Well, it must have been a huge camp.
It was a big camp, and it was a beautiful area. I mean, you know, it was on a lake, and Pittsfield, Massachusetts is a part of Massachusetts that's just, it's really, there are mountains, there are lakes, there's just everything. And so there were it was just a beautiful place to hang out. A lot of the kids from places like Long Island, so this was their chance to get out and actually have some outdoors for a few months during the summer.
So you must, it sounded like you had 20 or more coaches.
Right.
And so the number of kids had to be three times that, I'm sure.
We all multitasked too, though. So, for example, I was there to coach tennis and teach tennis, but I also coached basketball teams and baseball teams. And so you had the same counselors doing multiple things. They brought international counselors. There were the sort of English counselors, and there was a Pakistani counselor. There were counselors from the Scandinavian countries.
So this was a privileged camp.
Yeah, I would say. There were a couple of the kids who were the children of professional football players.
Do you remember who they were?
Well, there was a guy named Schoonover. I'm sure that's an invasion of confidentiality, but his name was Schoonover, and he was
Say his dad's name.
I don't know the dad's name, but I know he was a pro football player.
Okay.
There were some good kids. Really had a good time.
Were there international princes' children?
Not as much. But this is 1978.
Some?
No, I don't. If there were, I didn't know them. It was more the princes and princes from Long Island.
Okay.
And but they were but actually really nice kids. And so we lived in cabins. They had two counselors per cabin.
Was it pretty good pay, or was it room and board and spending money?
It was room and board and a little bit of pay, but it was a little bit of a, I would say it bordered on a scam, because if you got fired before the sixth week, you only got half your pay. And amazingly, about a third of the counselors got fired the sixth week. And I lasted the whole camp, but I thought, wow, that's not a great deal. Now, maybe they'd been in trouble for something, but
so you didn't get paid till the end of the camp.
You got paid a little bit about halfway through, and then if you made it to the end of the camp, you got paid the other half.
Okay,
so
are we talking big money?
No, maybe $500 total.
Total, okay. Yeah,
but back then, you could get a soda pop for a quarter, right?
Yeah. Well, I could get them for a nickel back.
Right, when I was a kid. Right.
Well, that sounds like it would have been a whole lot of fun. What about did they have women instructors?
They didn't have many. There was one tennis instructor whose boyfriend was a professional basketball player named Gail Gonderzak, and she helped coach on the women's side. But we were allowed to go into town, and so I think if we wanted to socialize, we had to leave the camp, and it was, if ours our night off, mm-hmm. we were allowed to go into town and socialize.
How far away was the town?
It was probably a 45-minute walk.
45-minute walk.
Right. So, and we didn't have cars.
Yeah.
One or two people had cars, but most of us didn't have cars.
So what size town was it?
It's a city, probably maybe a little bigger than Northfield, but not too much bigger.
Would you always end up getting a ride back?
Yeah. Usually what happened is there would be a person in the group who had a car, and then eight people would get in and ride into town, and then
flip them a quarter.
Gas. Chip in for gas. Yeah. I think gas was $1 a gallon, so maybe you could get away with that.
So that was another good time in your life.
That was fun. It was a lot of fun. And
that was between your freshman and sophomore year?
Right.
Okay.
But I'd missed tennis season, so at least I got a chance to play over the summer.
So now September comes along, and mm-hmm. it's time to come back for year two at Carleton.
Right.
And year two, did you still have two roommates, or did you find one roommate?
One of my roommates sort of brought me in. He got a great, I think I got a good number, and so he said, okay, I'll be willing to room with you. And I wasn't there, but they used my number to get a pretty nice place.
What does that mean? You got a good
There's
number.
A lottery. So yeah. In some campuses, if you've got more money, you can get a nicer room. At Carleton, you just go through the lottery, and if you got a good number, you got a good room.
Okay.
Which I think levels things out a little bit.
And where did you go your second year?
It was no dream palace, but it's called Musser. It's the sort of 1960s functionalist-looking building right over on the edge. If you see these townhouses,
yeah.
If you go up to the top, there's a pretty square, rectangular-looking building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but inside, it's a lot of fun.
I know who used to own that.
Okay.
Before Carleton bought
it. Okay.
I'll tell you off the air.
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
But it was it turned out to be a pretty decent place.
Yeah. Oh, I can see where it would be. I'd never have been in
that. People would write on the walls, and you could just wash it off. And
yeah.
So I would say on the outside, it's no great shakes, but on the inside, there was a nice sense of community. You rarely locked your doors, and I rarely got any homework done because people would come by with a backgammon set and sit with you for a couple hours. I finally started going and hiding out somewhere to get work done.
Did you ever go to the cave?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And they used to have the underground tunnels. And I think when I was at Carleton...
You weren't supposed to be in there, though, were you?
I think you were allowed to back then because okay. They didn't realize that asbestos was not good for you.
Yeah.
But I think when they figured that out, they got the caves closed down.
Okay.
There was a flasher for a while when I was here, and that was a little bit disturbing.
Not a what? Me.
A flasher. Somebody with a raincoat would...
Oh!
You know, you'd be
flasher.
Walking through this restrained place. And
yeah.
So I think it was a little bit disturbing. You know.
Oh.
I mean, when you think about it, you're underground. So people would tend to walk a couple people together.
Yeah. I never heard that. I'll have to ask a guy that news that works there that knows the tunnels.
Well, the neat thing is I have some friends who discovered a secret... I'm not sure if I should say this or not, but they found a secret door near the Watts line. There used to be a phone that you could use to call around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And behind it, there was a panel you could take out and get into the underground tunnels and then walk into the library. And I think they hijacked a painting of President Strong and then held it for ransom.
Okay, it sounds like fun.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. I never did that. I wasn't involved in that group, but I did have a chance to kind of navigate those tunnels. And it was sort of neat to think that you're, you know, on this campus and that there's a whole world underneath, I suppose.
Did your freshman year pique your interest in the St. Olaf campus?
What happened is my sophomore year when I was playing on the varsity, we stayed during the winter break in basketball. And so then we ate at St. Olaf because everything was closed down at Carleton. So we'd have our lunch and our dinner at St. Olaf. I think we had to kind of fend for ourselves for breakfast, maybe bagels or something. But then lunch and dinner we'd eat at St. Olaf, and so that was a lot of fun.
But didn't they serve breakfast at Carleton?
Well, I don't. But it was during the winter break because Carleton gets
early. Yeah, and that's Carleton, about when they start doing
that. Carleton's about done by Thanksgiving, and then suddenly you've got
and
5 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So we used to eat at St. Olaf, and that was fun. We'd get to meet some students.
Eat in the King's Room.
You know, I don't think they let us in the fancy places.
Cage?
I think it, upstairs in Flotton Hall was the dining room back then. So, you know, that Bunt Rock didn't exist, right?
No.
And so this was Flotton Hall, the art building now, but I think upstairs they had a nice cafeteria, and it was all you can eat, so that's all you need when you're 20 years old.
So when did you start playing basketball for Carleton?
I played freshman year, but I was on the JV, and then sophomore year I played JV varsity. And then junior year, I had a chance to study abroad, and I thought, you know, I'm not from a wealthy family, and I have a decent scholarship. I think this was a great opportunity, so I studied in Denmark junior year.
Where in Denmark?
In Copenhagen.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been to Denmark.
It's a pretty
Aarhus.
Incredible. Yeah. Oh, of course. It's wonderful.
First time we stayed there the first night, it was a hotel with a casino.
Right.
And we went down and messed around on the tables and... got enough money to pay our hotel bill, to pay the food bill, to pay everything. It was a pretty nice one night stay.
I can imagine.
Well, so Jack Thirdblad never coached you?
He coached me. I played for him first year, but the JV coach was a different coach. And then sophomore year, I played mostly. I mean, I played a lot on varsity, but I also got to play a little bit when we dressed as JV. And then junior year, I think I might have had a chance to start, but who knows? He had a good recruiting year, so it's possible I would have missed that wonderful study abroad program and still been knocked off by some hot shot freshman recruits. So I took off, and when I came back, Jack is a very fair guy. He said, "Charlie, you know, you might have played a lot this fall, but now these other kids have been playing for, you know, for months, and I can't just knock one of them off and put you on the varsity. You have to work your way up." And I thought, at that point, I just went to play intramurals. It was
so rating from 1 to 10, and be honest.
Right.
What would you say your skill as a guard was?
I would say maybe a 7.
Oh, so you're above average.
Oh no, I was a good high school player, and I think I was a respectably decent college player, but there were better players on the team.
Were you still in the Midwest or
what? In at Carleton?
In basketball, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We were in the Midwest Conference.
So you had to travel all that,
right?
Way to,
yeah,
to
and I think the first time I was playing varsity basketball, we did long trips to the University of Chicago and Lake Forest College and things like that.
So you traveled with the team.
Yeah, yeah. But I had a big game against Grinnell. I think I scored 7 points. That was my big game. So that shows you where I was at.
So
there were two of the better guards were injured, and so I got a lot of playing time that game.
So my question earlier to you, by the way, if you just tuned in, folks, my guest this morning is Charlie Cogan. And Charlie is talking about the years he spent at Carleton College and played basketball for Jack Thernblad. And I asked you about your high school never-forget moment, and that was when you stood your ground and a guy ran into you, but they called the foul on you. He got some foul shots, and you lost by a point or two. How about your most memorable moment you were involved in regards to Jack Thernblad or your career at Carleton, or a couple?
No, because I played only 2 years for Jack, I think my big memory was that we were playing a good team, and we were not doing very well against that good team. And we had good players. We had a guy named Jim Tolfe, who was our center, who I think ended up being all Midwest. He's a 7-foot center. I mean, one of the few times Carleton ever had somebody like that. And we still had a guy named Roy Hansen, who was a really big, strong moose of a guy. So we had a strong team, but we weren't doing it. And I just remember I was on a group called the Demon Squad at that point, where we would go in and harass the other team for about 2 or 3 minutes to give the real players a rest. And then he'd pull us back out and put the real players back in. And we got out there, and we weren't harassing him like we should. And he said, "Come on, guys, I put you in there to disrupt their game. And you're looking more tired than the starters." And I thought, so I guess that's my memorable moment, is that
the demons were done.
The demons were not demons. We were sub-demon, sub-demonic, you know. But we tried.
We'll be right back after this final break on the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. This is KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Let's Rodeo! The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, presented by Ram, stampedes the XL Energy Center. This Friday and Saturday, the stars of pro rodeo, Whiplash, the Cowboy Monkey, and Saturday night only see CMA artist Travis Denning in concert. Come early for pre-show fun. Tickets start at $20, and kids are half price at Ticketmaster.com. Like us on Facebook, save $5. The Cinch, world's toughest rodeo, more than an 8-second ride.
Yeah, that's what it is. Hey, I have to ask you a question, young man. And that is, of course, a gentleman by the name of Charlie Cogan, and that is Northfield, or I shouldn't say Northfield, KYMN Radio is going to be broadcasting the Wolves at the Suns 7:30 game today.
Did
you know that Kim Radio carries the Wolves?
No, that's good. That's good.
Who are the Suns?
That's Phoenix, I hope. I mean,
and
that's
called
change.
The Phoenix Suns? Huh?
Yeah, it makes sense.
I'm not... Basketball, I should tell you, basketball makes me nervous. That's
right.
Why I don't like to go to games professionally. All you have to do is tune in the last minute and
right.
It's over with. But it's just like when I'd go to a Raider game, right. You know, they'd be ahead, they'd be behind, they'd be ahead, they'd
nerve
be
wrecking.
Behind.
It's nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just, you know.
Yeah.
So your love for Jack Third lasted all the rest of his life.
I enjoyed when I came back. I immediately touched base with some of the people I'd known. I know Jack Third. I'd had John Dyer Bennett as a coach for tennis.
Okay.
And then Robert Bonner.
Oh,
Bob Bonner.
Yeah, the author.
They're wonderful yeah. coaches and mentors. So yeah. I think I appreciated them more when I was in my 30s. I think that I always felt like they were telling me what I shouldn't do when I was younger, but it was probably because I was doing things I shouldn't.
What role did Robert Bonner,
He coached me in tennis, and I think he was a very patient
really?
Man. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know him for his tennis.
Right. He's actually a good tennis player.
I didn't know that till just now. I do know that I served on the Laura Baker board of directors with Robert for 15-some years. I think he's still on there. I ran into him in the grocery store the other day, and I had interviewed him about his book.
Right. On Wild Bill, Buffalo Bill?
Yeah. And since then, I had gone to the Buffalo Bill
Museum?
Museum.
Sure.
In wherever it is we were out there, hinting heavily to give me a book.
Yeah, I think those are like gold.
Give me a book. I gave you all this time on the air to talk about your book. I went out there, mentioned your name. He hasn't taken the hint yet. So if you run into him, just tell him, hey, give Wayne a book.
Yeah, okay, I'll tell him. I have a book, but I think I lent it to a friend from Wyoming who liked it so much he never gave it back.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think I got Bob to sign it, too. So if I can rescue that book, I'll hand it over.
Oh, you know what? I was on the cover of Today magazine.
Sure.
And he had me sign that.
Nice.
He asked me to sign that. And
so there's some reciprocity involved.
So next time you see him, just say, hey, you know, you will love to do this. He'll understand that language.
He was just inducted into the Carlton Hall of Fame last spring.
Okay.
And a lot of his really good players came back for that. And I naively went out and played with them and realized that after I graduated, they got a lot better.
Yeah.
But that's okay. It was good to.
Well, you just tell him I'd love to have one, or I'll take him to court.
Okay. Well, I think he can listen. He's listening right now.
And the net result would be that I would get a book, and that would be quite a racket if he had to try to sell it to me. Yeah. Get all the humor there?
Yeah.
Not that. Well, the net results
would
be. Not
very good, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Well, obviously, we're not done.
Yeah.
And you're going on another field trip?
Not right away.
International?
Not right away.
Okay.
Not right away. We've kind of seen through this year's students, and they've all applied,
mm-hmm.
and they'll be waiting for a couple of months to get their decisions. And so there's a little pause, and I actually was only mentoring one student at that point. I got younger students.
Well, I'm talking about, I'm still in college.
Oh, okay.
I'm at Carleton. Okay, your sophomore year, you played basketball.
Right, right.
And you were a demon for Jack Third.
Right, right.
And then
which is to say a glorified scrub, but it was still fun. It was still fun, yeah.
And so your junior year, you decide that, hey, I'm not going to play on a varsity level. I'm going to take another international course.
In Denmark, yeah.
In Denmark.
At the University of Copenhagen.
Boy. And that
it was really neat.
Yeah, I was going to say that would have been what year? 80?
1980. I think when I was in Denmark, Ronald Reagan was elected president.
1980, Denmark, Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Boy, but you learned a lot there.
It was actually a great program. The courses were taught in English.
Mm-hmm.
But what I hadn't realized is that Danish, you know, the Danes conquered England so many times. And then the French conquered England. So if you take English and if you take French and Danish and put them together, you've got English more or less. So with that, it was a fascinating language, and I enjoyed studying Danish. And we studied history from a Danish perspective, which meant that everything was all about the Vikings. And then we studied European politics. It was actually really a good course. It's called Danish International Studies, and students still go on that program.
Did you get to meet the Queen?
You know, I guess I didn't pull rank on that. I did get a really nice jacket at the Ragstock before I went. That was so nice that when I went to the Royal Copenhagen Ballet, people complimented me on it, and it did cost me $5. But I didn't get to meet any royalty at all. Or if I did, they were maybe dressing down and pretending like they weren't royalty.
Did you go to the Lego factory?
Didn't make it to the Lego factory. Fast. I went to the Carlsberg factory about 7 times.
Oh, okay. The Lego factory is really amazing.
I know it is.
I took a video of it, of an airport, and I showed it to, you know, how you like to show.
Sure.
And people thought it was real. I mean, I said, here's the airport where our plane landed. And then I said, that's it's all Lego.
No, it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing.
Well, let's pick up from Denmark and go on and find out how you ended up back in Northfield on another date that's convenient for you.
Sure, sure.
And I enjoyed talking to you very much. I really appreciated Charlie Cogan. And hopefully you mentioned that your wife was listening last time, I believe.
That was my mother.
Your mother, mom, okay.
I sent her the link.
Oh, okay. Did you do it again?
I'll do it again. I'll do this one as well. And okay. She can correct all my mistakes on this one, too.
All right.
She's a teacher, so it comes naturally to her.
Well, you know, she can listen live.
Right, right.
Okay.
I should tell her.
Yeah.
But she's in Iowa City.
Yeah.
She can? Okay, good.
Stream.
Oh, okay,
we
gotcha.
Stream. Just turned it on the computer.
Oh, nice.
Or on the phone.
Right.
If she's at the, you know, like the hair beauty shop or something. What I was just saying, the convenience of the phone, that's the connection. Charlie, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Any last word you want from today's interview?
No, I appreciate it. This is always fun.
Okay. Thank you. Goodbye, good luck, and God bless.
Okay.
Till
Nästa gång.